Well, it's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I actually came out to run with David and thought while I was here I'd squeeze in a bit of speaking as well. That's the thing that really attracted me. Perhaps we'll start by reading from God's Word, a passage that was particularly important to Martin Luther. So I'll take the reading this evening from the letter of Paul to the Romans, chapter 1, and I'll read from verses 1 to verse 17, and I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son, who was descended from David according to the flesh, and was declared to be the Son of God in power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord, through whom we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all the nations, including you who are called to belong to Christ Jesus. To all those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I am eager to preach the gospel to you also, who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Well, October is always an auspicious month in the church history calendar because this is the month where we have the anniversary of Luther's nailing of the so-called 95 Theses against indulgences to the castle wall in Wittenberg. And he raises the question immediately of why is Luther significant? Is he still significant? Should we read him? What is the purpose in reading Luther? Well, I want to suggest there are numerous reasons why one might wish to read Luther today. Not least of all, I think of all of the reformers in the 16th century. He's by far the most human. When you read the great reformers, by and large, if you're looking for biographical information or you're looking for entertainment, you don't find it there. Calvin and company, by and large, don't talk about themselves very much. And certainly write with a certain reserve about their lives and about the people they knew. Luther isn't like that at all. Luther was a man of excesses. He drank too much. He uses bad language when he writes. He was an explosive figure, like so many great figures in history. His strengths were equally balanced by awesome weaknesses. And when he sinned, he always sinned in the most spectacular and sort of, from a historian's point of view, entertaining of fashions, if you like. So Luther is an interesting figure as historical, theological figures go. Bit of a volcano. He also lived at an extremely interesting time. And I want to spend a few moments before I start thinking about Luther himself to reflect upon the kind of time in which he lived. Because there's always a danger that we tend, when we look back in time, we tend to forget that these are human beings. They live in particular times and places. They grew up, they were children once upon a time. They were formed by the environment around them. So it's important for us to know something of that environment in order to understand where they're coming from. Well, 15th and 16th century, it's a very disturbing time in Europe. Now, I don't know how many of you, I noticed there are quite a number of children in the audience today. How many children, how many of you are planning to do with the rest of your lives what your dad does? Does that appeal at all? By and large? Generally speaking, I suspect today kids think of dads as rather boring people. And on the whole, unless your dad happens to be a professional footballer or a baseball player, you don't really at this stage have ambitions to do what he did, do what he does. Well, in the 15th and 16th centuries, if you'd been a little boy or a little girl, then really by the time you were 5 or 6, you'd be aware of what you were going to do for the rest of your life. Because you're probably going to do exactly what your dad does. And your dad wouldn't have been anything exciting like a football player or a baseball player. More than likely he'd have been a farmer. Or he'd have been somebody who worked on a farm. And his job would have been to sow seed, make sure it grows, water it if necessary, then cut it down a certain time of year, take it off to the barn. And if you're a little girl, well, mum's job was what? Well, mum, she has children. Or you would say mom, I think here. I probably don't say it right. What would mom do? Mum has children. Mum is at home and the children grow up. And when the children move out and mum can't have children anymore, maybe she does a bit of weaving or she does some sewing or she cooks for dad, but she doesn't do very much. And if you're a little girl, then you know that's kind of what you're going to do when you're older. The world's a sort of pretty safe place. And you know, if you're growing up in this environment and you're out and you're running along the lane one day playing with your friends and you fall over and you hurt your knee and you cut your knee, where do you go to for help? Well, you probably live in a village. And you know everybody in the village. Most of them are like cousins or aunts or uncles. So you can go to any house in your village and ask for help. Because you know who lives there. And probably spookiest of all, by the time you're 5 or 6, you've probably already met who you're going to marry. Now that's a kind of, I guess for the children here today, it might be kind of scary when you think of the girls, you know. Probably, you're not very keen on thinking you're going to spend the rest of your life with any of them. But if you lived in the 15th, 16th century when Luther did, that was kind of the world. Kind of the world we live in. You grew up in the 15th century, by the time you were 5, you knew what you were going to do for the rest of your life. You knew everybody in your village. You were never going to move out of your village. And you knew that, well, you may not know exactly who you're going to marry, but there were like a dozen candidates out there, and you knew it was going to be one of them. And then suddenly everything starts to change. At the end of the 15th century, in Europe, what happens is cities start to grow. People start to move away from the villages and they go to the cities. And cities, they're not like, it's not like living in the country. I grew up in the country and everybody was either a farmer or they did something connected to farming. But cities grow because people are starting to trade things. They're starting to move things around Europe and sell them. Those books over there. People are starting to print books. You don't grow books, you have to print them. And there's money to be made there. So people start to move out of their villages and go to the cities. And that has really kind of strange impact on the way you live. Because maybe you're one of the people. You've grown up at the age of 5, you thought you'd got life planned out pretty well. You were going to be a farmer like your dad. And you're going to marry the girl next door, and you're going to live in the middle of your family. But by the time you're 18, you're hearing it. You can make big money in the cities. So you move to the city. Suddenly you meet all these new people you've never met before. You're not related to them. And you meet another girl you've never met before, and you fall in love with her, and you decide you're going to marry her, and not the girl that lived next door to you back in the village. And maybe the town, the city you've moved to, is like 100 miles away from your village. It's like as far as Denver is from Colorado Springs. Now that's trivial. You've probably gone in the car with your mum and dad and driven to Denver from here. If you're really lucky, maybe you've flown, and it's taken you. If you're flying, maybe it takes half an hour. If you're driving, maybe it takes a couple of hours. But if you live 100 miles away from your mum and dad in the 16th century, maybe you never see them again. My mum lives probably from here, like 5,000 miles away. I could hop on a plane and see her by tomorrow night. It'd be pretty easy. But if I'd lived 100 miles away from her in Luther's day, I'd never have seen her again. And Europe is changing. These cities are growing and people are moving out of the villages and going to the cities. And when you move to the city is a scary place because you don't know people there. And if you stay in the villages become kind of scary places because people are leaving. And you have to work even harder to get all the food in because there are less people there to work. So the world at the start of the 16th century where Luther's growing up is a world of change. All of the old kind of certainties are beginning to change. Except there's one place, even if you live in a city, there's one place you can go to which is just like it is back home. I live a long way from my home, and you know, there's a place in Philadelphia down by the docks. And I walk through the door there, and it's a sort of sports bar, really. But when you walk through the door and shut the door behind it, it's full of British people. No American people there. It's full of British people, and they're all wearing what we call football strips, what you would call soccer outfits or something, I guess. And they're playing British football on the television. And I'm not a big British football fan. But when I go there, it's kind of reassuring, because it's just like it is back home. Just like it is back home. Everybody, they say mum and not mom, for example. And they watch the football game. And we all understand what's going on. There was a place like that in the 16th century. It was called the church. Even when you move to the city, you could go to the church and it's just like it was back home. Just like it was back home. You could be really comfortable there because even though you didn't understand a word that was being said, that didn't matter. You didn't go there to understand. You went there for it to be just like it was back home. And yet that's all about to change because of Martin Luther. Martin Luther, this man who grew up in this world that was beginning to change under his feet, becomes one of the greatest agents of change that the church has ever seen. So I want to spend today, really today, run through some of his life, and then tomorrow look more at what he said. But today I'll focus upon his life. He was born in 1483, right at the end of the 15th century, right at the time that all these amazing changes are starting to happen. And his dad had been a miner. You know what a miner is? Somebody who goes down, you know, works underground, digs up coal. It's a dangerous job to do today. Goodness knows how dangerous it must have been in the 15th and 16th centuries. Terribly dangerous job. But his dad had risen from being a miner to being the manager of a mine. So as the world was changing, Luther's family was sort of benefiting from these changes. No longer did you always have to do what you were born to do. You could better yourself. And Luther's father, he didn't want his son to be a miner. He didn't even want his son to be a mine manager. He wanted his son to be a lawyer. His son was not going to have to work with his hands as he had done. He was going to go off to the big city and get qualifications and become a lawyer. So he sends Luther off at the age of 18 to a town called Erfurt in Germany, where there's an ancient university. And Luther starts to study law there. And then one day, 4 years later, in 1505, he's walking home. He's going from home to the university. He's heading back to the university, having visited his mother and father at home. And he's caught in the middle of a raging thunderstorm. Now, I'm guessing with the climate of Colorado being dry and warm, I think I'll merely take this off and try not to wander around. I'm guessing with the climate of Colorado being dry and warm, thunderstorms are not an uncommon phenomenon here. Would that be a safe bet? So you know what thunderstorms are like. Be wild and frightening. Luther's walking back from his home to university and he's caught in the middle of an almighty thunderstorm and a bolt of lightning comes crashing down in his side, throws him on his face. I've only ever once been in the approximate area of a thunderbolt strike. I was on the phone in the back room of my house 2 or 3 years ago and a bolt of lightning landed in the back garden. Awesome thing. All I saw for a split second was a sort of 6-foot column of bright blue light, and the whole house shook to the extent that things fell off shelves. The whole house just rocked as if it was an earthquake. Luther's out in the middle of this. Bolt, lightning bolt, strikes his side, throws him flat on his face, and he cries out in fear, "St. Anne, save me and I'll become a monk." Often wondered, why did he call out to St. Anne? He calls out to St. Anne because St. Anne is the patron saint of miners. And he'd obviously been well taught by his godly parents, the pious parents. The piety of his home was a piety focused around St. Anne, the patron saint of miners. And in this desperate situation, he calls out to her for help and says, "If I survive this, I'll become a monk." Well, he does survive. And just 10 days later, he presents himself at the local monastic order, the Augustinian Order of Monks, for taking the monastic habit. Terribly disappointing to his father. His father had got this idea, he was going to become a lawyer, he was going to make a lot of money, he was going to bring prestige and honour to the house, the family of Luther. Luther's chosen to become a monk, and not only that, he's chosen to become an Augustinian, which was a fairly small, unimportant order of monks. A bit like getting a full-ride scholarship to Princeton and turning it in to go to, I don't know, Colorado Springs Community College. It would have that sort of impact on the family. So Luther becomes a monk, and he's driven, almost I think from the moment that he has this near-death experience, he's driven by a single overriding question. And the question is this: where can I find a gracious God? You can expand the question more broadly and say, how can I, a sinner, stand before God? Where is God's grace to be found for me? And Luther is taught by his masters in the monastery that there is a relatively simple answer to this question. And the answer is this: God, although God is holy, he's also supremely powerful. And therefore God can determine the arrangements by which one relates to him. And God, because he knows that human beings are fallen and they're sinful, has set up this arrangement with human beings whereby if they do their best, he'll be gracious to them. It's a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant idea because it's individually tailored to particular people. David's best may not be my best. For David, doing his best might be, you know, in the 16th century, getting up and saying 100 Hail Marys before breakfast. For me, though, I sleep longer. So I have, you know, for me, it might be saying 80 Hail Marys before breakfast. The thing is, God meets us each, if you like. He looks upon our intention and our effort, and he's gracious to us as a result of that. It's very interesting. What it effectively does, it does to sort of human works, if you like, doing things to please God, turns it into a kind of paper currency. Got a $20 bill here. Any of the clever children out there, tell me how much the $20 bill is worth. It's not a trick question. How much is a $20 bill worth? You're a clever lad. $20. You'll go far. Whatever, you never sell a $20 bill to somebody for $10. It's not worth it. It's worth $20. But is it worth $20? You can see I'm rolling in it today. I got $21 on me. I got a $1 bill here. Now, one of the most interesting things about American culture is I think it's the only country in the world where all the dollars, the currency is about the same size and the same color. How much is this? You're on a roll. That's worth a dollar. So if you had this $20 and I said, "I'll have you $20 off you for a dollar," you wouldn't give it to me, would you? You would. You need to talk to me afterwards. And bring that $20 bill along with you. But the intrinsic value is about the same, isn't it? I bet it doesn't cost the central bank any more money to print a dollar bill than it does to print a $20 bill. It's the same amount of paper. It's the same amount of ink. It's the same process. So the value is extrinsically given. The bank, if you like, tells you what that piece of paper is worth, and tell you that this is worth 20 and this is worth 1. And Luther's being taught that, you know, God's a bit like that when it comes to works. You do your best. And say, David's best might be considerably better than my best. But God decides what its real value is, and he extrinsically says, yeah, I'll give you grace for that. And yeah, well, Truman, given the circumstances and who he is, I'll give him grace for what he's done, even though it's not intrinsically not quite as good as what David's done. This seems to be a brilliant solution to Luther's problem. Where can I find a gracious God? Well, just do your best and God will be gracious to you. The problem for Luther comes, however, in that he can never know when he's done his best. Luther becomes the most committed of monks, passionate in his commitment to the monastic task, whether it is works of charity or whether it is the sort of works of piety, whether it's helping people, cleaning the monastery, or saying prayers, saying vespers. Luther is passionately committed to these things. But the harder he does them, the more convinced he is that he falls short. How can he ever know that he's done his best? How does he know that 100 Hail Marys is really his best? Maybe if he got up 5 minutes earlier, he could have squeezed another one or two in there. He can never know. And so the system that's designed to help Luther slowly drives him to distraction. And his thoughts, all of his horrific thoughts, come to focus on this first chapter of Romans that I've read. And it's really those last two verses. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed. That haunts Luther. Luther understands law. God's law tells him what he's got to do. It reveals his righteousness. It sets the standard. Now he turns to Romans. He's looking for some good news here. And what does Romans tell him? The gospel reveals the righteousness of God. So for Luther, this is bad news. Not only is the law bad news, it tells you about the standards God demands of you and constantly leaves you in doubt as to whether you've reached them. But according to Paul in Romans, the gospel reveals the righteousness of God as well. The gospel merely rubs salt in the wound. It leaves you more uncomfortable. And yet in the second decade of the 16th century, Luther makes a series of breakthroughs that help him to understand what's going on. The first thing he comes to is a realization that he's been taught wrong about baptism. He's been taught that baptism is a washing. Why is that significant? Well, your understanding of baptism will often connect your understanding of sin. That seems to be how it works in the history of theology. Luther's been told baptism is a washing because sin is basically, it's a wound or it's dirt. You need to be clean or you need to be healed. Luther comes through his reading and lecturing on the letters of Paul to understand that baptism is not a washing and sin is not uncleanness. Baptism is death and resurrection. And sin isn't a wound. Sin is a status of death. And what Luther's being taught with this theology of baptism and with this idea that you just do your best and you can get through, he's being taught that his problem is you're wounded. Do your best. You've only got one leg. Okay, we know you're not going to do a sub-10 second 100 meter run. But if you can hop along and do it in a minute, we'll count you as a champion. Luther's coming to the conviction, though, the problem is it's not that the guy at the end of at the start of the race has only got one leg. It's that he's lying dead on the ground. And you can shout all you want at him and say, okay, just get up and run the 100 metres any way you can and we'll count you a champion. You can shout as loud as you want to a dead person and they're not going to get up. Reminds me, just as a sort of a humorous aside, I guess, British people notoriously bad at learning other people's languages. I have a suspicion that Americans might be the same, but I can't speak firsthand of that. But British certainly are. And the philosophy of British people abroad is, you know, when you meet somebody who doesn't speak English, you merely shout louder and slower at them. And you keep doing it because you just know that there is this bedrock of English under there somewhere, and you've just got to break through to it. Well, kind of that's what Luther's been taught about the law. If you just keep hammering the law away at somebody, sooner or later they're going to get up and crawl to the finish line. But the bottom line for Luther is no. Human beings are dead in their sins. So what is the answer? And this is what points Luther to Christ. The problem is so immense, death, that only the incarnation and death and resurrection of God himself can solve the problem. And it's when Luther realizes that the righteousness of God revealed in the gospel is actually the righteousness revealed in the life and death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, that he comes to understand the gospel. That it isn't something you do, it's something you grasp by faith. Well, all of that, of course, going on in the second decade of the 16th century. Why does it lead to the Reformation? One of the fascinating things about the church of Luther's day is it's impossible for Luther to be heretical on justification. Virtually impossible in the early part of the 16th century, because the church has no position on justification. When Luther comes up with all this great new stuff in the second decade, the 16th century, it's not obvious it's wrong. So what is it that gets him into trouble? Well, it's this. There are events happening all over Europe that are conspiring, really, to catapult Luther to fame. The Pope has been engaged in a series of ill-fated military conflicts with the Holy Roman Empire. Europe, mainland Europe, is sort of governed, really, by two powers. The Holy Roman Empire and the papacy. And they are intermittently at war with each other. And the Pope has been slowly but surely bankrupted by this. He's also taken on the most amazing building project, St. Peter's in Rome. And he's brought Michelangelo in to do the beautiful frescoes and the paintings. I often joke to students, you know, Michelangelo, surely the most expensive interior decorator in history. And the Pope employs him at just the point where he's running out of money. But then something happens within the Holy Roman Empire. Think of it as kind of Germany, effectively, the Holy Roman Empire, that potentially opens up streams of income for the Pope. There's a man called Albrecht of Mainz. He's the Bishop of Mainz. He's actually the Bishop of two places. And he wants to be the Bishop of a place called Brandenburg. Why does he want to be a Bishop of three places? There are tax-raising powers. If you're a bishop, you can levy taxes. So it's lucrative. Albrecht of Brandenburg has a problem, though. Church rules say you can only have two bishoprics. You can't have three. But, as is the way in the 16th century, you can buy exceptions to the rules. If you pay the Pope enough, he'll grant you an exception. It's quite funny, when I was applying for my green card when I first came over here, I was told, you know, it'll take you 3 years. It actually took longer than 3 years because I arrived in August 2001, just before the terrorist attacks in September. But I was originally told, you know, if you go through the process, it'll take probably 3 years. But if you want to pay a certain amount of money up front, then it can be done in 12 months. I remember thinking, wow, in Africa they call that bribery. But here it's kind of part of the official procedure. Well, it's a bit like that in the 16th century in Rome. There's a tendency to think, well, he's bribing the Pope. Well, he isn't. It's actually perfectly legal to pay the Pope off to do these things, even though it may not be morally particularly admirable. But Albrecht says to the Pope, can I pay you to get an exemption? And the Pope says, sure, you can pay me to get an exemption. The way that you can raise the money is, the Pope says, I'll permit you to borrow money from a big German banking house, and you can pay me then for this exception. And then, he said, what I'll do is I'll allow you to raise an indulgence on your territory. You raise an indulgence, and that will raise a certain amount of money, and half of it you give to me, and half of it you use to pay off the loan from the bank. So the Pope has a really nice deal here. He gets both paid for the exemption and he's getting half the proceeds from the indulgence. Question, what is an indulgence? You're a 16th century Catholic. You don't just believe in heaven and hell, you also believe in purgatory, this place in between, where most people, unless they're really super saints, will go. Purgatory is the place where you go to be cleaned up before you finally make it to heaven. And in the late Middle Ages, a system was developed whereby if you give the Pope a certain amount, if you give the Church a certain amount of money, you can buy a certificate from the Church that will actually grant a certain number of days, months, years, centuries of purgatory, either for you or for a loved one of your choice. So what the Pope does is he says to Albrecht, you can, in the Holy lands of the Holy Roman Empire, the German territories, you can raise an indulgence. You can allow an indulgence salesman to come in and sell these certificates to people. Think about it. Who are you going to be selling these certificates to, generally speaking? Poor people. As it is now, so it was then. The most vulnerable people for the con merchants are going to be the poor and the less well educated. Secondly, it's going to have a powerful appeal. The man who sells it, a guy called Tetzel. Tetzel has some amazing sales pitches. The effect of, you know, if you're worried about where Granny is at the moment, you know, she died and you loved her, but you know as well as I do, she was, you know, she got a bit of a tongue on her. You know, she was a problem. Unlikely that she got straight to heaven. She's going to be stuck in purgatory. And purgatory, we're not talking here, but you don't spend a decade in purgatory. Even good people spend sort of 10,000 years there. Now, Granny is going to be spending a long, long time in purgatory. But if you give me some money, we can get the sentence reduced. That is a powerful emotional appeal. You know, and before we, you know, don't think that we've sort of moved too far beyond that. You know, you go home and switch on your television channel and see the Benny Hinns of this world operating. I would say, one, they're preying on the poorest and the most vulnerable people in society with their credit card hotlines. And two, they're con men, con merchants. It's a false gospel, and they're peddling it for profit. So our own age is not that different to Luther. Our indulgence salesmen may wear Armani suits now, where they used to wear monk's cowls, but they're just as with us as they always were. So Tetzel starts to make his way through Germany. And Tetzel was a profane man. I mean, he would even say that one of his lines was, every time a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. To the more distasteful, even if you had raped the Virgin Mary, if you buy one of my indulgences, it will square the sin away. So he was a foul-mouthed and profane man. He doesn't come into Luther's territory. He doesn't come into Luther's parish because Luther's parish, the prince, who's the sort of the governor of Luther's territory, he has his own little trade in indulgences going. Luther himself is unsure about indulgences at this point. But what's happening is the poor in Luther's parish are crossing over the river to the neighbouring parish and buying indulgences. It becomes a problem for Luther at that point. In the same way that a pastor at a very sound evangelical or Reformed Church might well find that Benny Hinn becomes a problem. Because if he comes to town, somebody in the congregation is probably going to go and hear what he has to say. So Luther faces this problem. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie. It's quite a good movie, done a few years ago. Inevitably, I think, for an American-made movie, Tetzel, the sleazy ratbag, is played by an English actor. But it's slightly counterbalanced by the fact that Luther also is played by an English actor. So it's sort of, it's not quite as ethnically insensitive as it might have been. But there is this great scene, quite a moving scene in the movie, which may well have been, this scene may well never have happened, but something like it must have happened, where Luther is walking down the high street and he meets this poor young girl with a baby strapped to her back. I can't remember if it's her own baby or if it's one she's looking after, or a young sister or something, but she's clutching in her hand this piece of paper, and her face lights up when she sees Luther, and she says, look at what I've used my money on. This is money that should have gone to buy food for the family or shoes for the feet, presumably. I bought this indulgence. And in the movie, that's the moment where Luther sort of, you know, his face hardens and you realize, yeah, this is the moment where he has to speak. So the Reformation is triggered by Luther producing a list of what are called theses, points for debate. It's nothing more radical than that. He's advertising a debate on the issue of indulgences. And he nails them to the castle door. And it's that scene took place so many years ago, anniversary is tomorrow night, captured so often in Protestant artwork where, you know, Luther is shown symbolically putting a nail through the heart or into the coffin of the medieval church. There's nothing like that at all, actually. It's just like putting up a notice on a church billboard that you're going to have a debate. But it's that that triggers the Reformation. And it's important to grasp that, because why is it important? Because it shows you the Reformation was in origin a pastoral crisis. Now, there is a tendency to think of theology as something that floats up there and really gets in the way of ministry a lot of the time, or gets in the way of being a Christian. But actually, the Reformation was driven by theology, because Luther's understanding of the righteousness of God, the sinfulness of human beings, and the costliness of Christ's sacrifice meant that to him it was blasphemy to sell the grace of God like some kind of commodity on the open market, where, you know, you could live how you wanted and then buy God's grace by a mere cash transaction. Didn't work that way. Luther actually thought indulgences at that point, he did think indulgences could have a proper use. And the proper use was if the cash transaction reflected an inner change of heart. Yeah, like if David, for example, if I steal David's car tonight and go out and trash it, and then David comes to me tomorrow and says, "You stole my car and trashed it," and I laugh and say, "Yeah, it was a blast. But, you know, well, you know, what was it worth? $5,000 or something? Here's $5,000, now go away and shut up about it." That's an inappropriate indulgence. That's not a proper indulgence. But if David came to me and said, "You know, you trashed my car, and I didn't give you permission to take it away, let alone trash it last night," and my heart is convicted and I burst into tears and I beg him for forgiveness, and he says, "Well, I need a sign that your repentance is genuine. How much money have you got in your bank account?" And I say, $5,000. And he said, "Well, give me everything you've got and I'll know that you're genuinely repentant." And I give him $5,000. For Luther, that's a proper indulgence. The problem in 1517 for Luther is indulgences, the way they're being sold by Tetzel, remove the grace of God from any idea of repentance and faith in Christ. Luther, there's a great line. I don't often quote the 20th century theologian Karl Barth in a sort of positive context, but there's a great line in Karl Barth's writing when he's talking about a book he wrote, a commentary on Romans, and he said, "I was like somebody stumbling along in the dark, and I tripped over, and as I fell forward, I put out my hand and I caught this rope to stop me from falling over. As I pulled down on the rope," he said, "high above me I heard a church bell ringing." It's a great kind of analogy for what goes on here in 1517. Luther advertises what he thinks will be a fairly simple debate on how indulgences should be used. Within days, weeks, it's translated into German and it's spread over the German lands and becomes the rallying cry for a major social and religious rebellion against the church. I haven't got time to go through all of the details of what happens in the next few years, but the church makes a number of fatal errors. If I'd been the Pope, the thing to do would have been to have operated as ruthlessly as possible, as early as possible. Have Luther snatched and taken to Rome and executed. Actually, what the church do is they underestimate what's going on. They don't realize that Luther's insights into salvation and justification are going to bring the whole of medieval Catholicism and Catholic theology collapsing around their ears. So they say to the Augustinians, "Well, you sort it out. You've got a meeting coming up in April 1518. You deal with it there." I want to talk about that meeting tomorrow in more detail. Probably the most important theology of Luther's life is expounded and talked about at that meeting, There can be no turning back after that point. Luther is then helped massively by the fact that his boss, Frederick the Wise, the governor of Electoral Saxony, is what they call an elector of the Holy Roman Empire. Europe, the Holy Roman Empire is not a democracy. It's run by an emperor. But interestingly enough, as emperors go, the emperor's son doesn't automatically take over when he dies. The emperor dies, there are seven guys called electors who have to meet together, and they elect the next emperor. And Luther is very lucky that Frederick the Wise, the leader of Electoral Saxony, even though Electoral Saxony is a fairly small territory, it's a poor territory, it doesn't have a huge army, for historical reasons, Frederick the Wise is an elector. And that means he cannot be ignored. And you can't simply, the emperor can't simply roll into Electoral Saxony and seize Luther. That would cause civil war. All of the other electors would immediately declare war on the emperor. So Luther's very lucky in that Rome, from late 1518 onwards, is really pushing to have him taken to Rome in order to be summarily tried and executed. Quite a couple of amusing incidents happen. There's an incident in a monastery in Dresden. Luther's invited by the monks at Dresden to go and meet with them to talk about his theology. And they know Luther well. So what they do is they arrange this great kind of party where there's plenty of beer and wine. Luther loved his beer. The thing he loved most about his wife was she was a great home brewer. But he wasn't married to her at this point, but I'm sure that was part of his, a delight to him when he discovered that was the case after he'd married her. My own wife hates beer and couldn't homebrew for her life, I'm sure. We live in a time of decline, I guess. Anyway, Luther's invited to this party in Dresden. And the monks, they basically get him drunk. And Luther's, the more he drinks, the more outrageous he becomes. And finally they say, what do you really think about the Pope? And after a few pints inside him, Luther tells him what he really thinks about the Pope. And it's a little bit like, given the level of technology, it's a little bit like the sort of Nixon Watergate issue, in that they don't have voice-activated recording gear in the 16th century. So what they do is they've stuck another monk behind a curtain in the room who's writing down everything that Luther says, putting in a report and sending it to Rome. Well, the Pope is not best pleased when he finds out what Luther really thinks about him. The Pope then commissions one of his sort of right-hand man, a man called Mazzolini, to write a theological opinion on Luther. This is 1518. How can we prosecute this man? Tell me what he's saying that's wrong. Well, Mazzolini writes this book called A Dialogue Against the Presumptuous Conclusions of Martin Luther. And Mazzolini says, Luther's such an idiot, it took me 3 days to write this thing. I can dismiss him in 3 days. I think it's a very interesting insight into Luther's instinctive grasp of how the new medium of print can be used. Typically in the 16th century, in fact, right down to the 1960s, Vatican II, the way that the Catholic Church generally approached books of which it did not approve was to ban them. There's a book by Anthony Kenny, who was a former Catholic priest. He ended his career as a professor of logic at the University of Oxford, very clever man, but wrote about how in the 1950s, when he was studying at Rome, he had to get papal permission to read David Hume, the empiricist philosopher, atheist philosopher from the 18th century, had to get papal permission, and then could only read David Hume in a certain book at the Gregorian, in a certain room in the Gregorian University. Catholics, generally speaking, or the Catholic Church, took a view to print media that was the way you suppress it is by suppressing it, physically, if necessary. Luther gets this book Mazzolini's written, and then he does something very interesting. He doesn't burn it, he reprints it. He has it reprinted in Wittenberg with a new introduction, written by guess who? Martin Luther. And just for good measure, he says, Mazzolini wrote this book in 3 days. He said, it only took me two to write my introduction that refutes it. Luther had this instinctive grasp of the way to beat somebody when it comes to print media was to subvert them. He didn't burn books, he subverted them. by republishing his own editions with his own introductions. And I think that's a great insight into why Luther was so successful. Because for a man who really grew up in the Middle Ages and was trained at a medieval university, he seems to have this instinctive grasp of how the modern media operates. Well, things progress. The emperor dies, fortunately for Luther, and that delays legal actions against him. He debates a man called John Eck at the University of Leipzig. And what I want to bring things to a conclusion today, that's in 1519. He's excommunicated, 1520 and 1521. 1519, a new emperor, Charles V, is elected. Probably the worst time ever for a Holy Roman Emperor to be elected, because Charles V will really preside over decades of war, the church collapsing, Europe beginning to fall apart around his feet. The church moves in 1520 to excommunicate Luther. On the 15th of June, releases a papal bull with the title Exsurge Domine, taken from Psalm 74:22. Arise, O Lord. It's proclaimed in the Vatican on the 24th of July, and then it's sent through Germany. Guess who carries it through Germany? Tetzel, our old friend, the indulgence salesman, and John Eck, the man that Luther debated at Leipzig. It arrives in Wittenberg on the 10th of October. And Luther, in December of 1520, leads a procession through Wittenberg with the papal bull and has it burned. Now, I've just said, you know, Luther didn't burn books. The significance for Luther of burning the papal bull was not to try to stop it seeping out, if you like. It was not a censorship thing. It was a profoundly symbolic thing. By burning the papal bull of excommunication that cast him out of the church, along with the books of canon law, legal foundational documents of the church, he was essentially thumbing his nose at the whole Roman hierarchy. So if you're looking for the year, the date, if you like, when the Reformation really starts, 10th of December, 1520, would be the day. The church is now in a real dilemma. The church has excommunicated Luther. Once you've done everything you can do and the guy is still there, what do? Well, the church decides at this point, got to hand it over to the empire. Charles V has got to deal with this. Problem is, of course, he's excommunicated. If you're excommunicated, you're a non-person. So how do you mount a legal case against a non-person? Well, they decide they'll ignore that bit. They will sort of treat Luther as a person. And they summons him to a meeting, a diet, what's called a diet of the Holy Roman Empire in the city of Worms. And the build-up to the Diet of Worms in 1521 is interesting. Luther begins to go on the sort of rhetorical rampage. Those old enough to remember Muhammad Ali, it's the kind of trash talk that Muhammad Ali would engage in before a fight. I saw a documentary on the Rumble in the Jungle where Norman Mailer is interviewed. And Mailer was at the ringside in Kinshasa at the fight. And he says, you know, at the end of round one, I looked up and I looked into Muhammad Ali's eyes and I saw something there I'd never seen before. I could see he was frightened. You know, everybody now knows George Foreman as this kind of everybody's granddad who sells tires and, you know, teaches people how to grill. I mean, he was a real monster in the early 1970s. He was frightened. And I think it's an insight into what trash talk is, of course. Big trash talk tends to be a way of compensating for fear. And Luther's trash talk is never as good as it is in late 1520 and early 1521. He must be terrified. I think he must be terrified. Finally, though Luther makes his way through the German lands to Worms, preaching to packed houses along the way, if you're looking for the 16th century equivalent of a rock star, Believe it or not, it is Martin Luther. And there's more to it just than in preaching to packed houses along the way. It's round about this time that the trade in Luther posters kicks off in Germany. And I think Luther is the first modern pinup. I'm not sure that anybody ever generated a trade in pictures during their lifetime in the way that Luther does in the early 16th century. I think it's quite amusing. You imagine a mother going into a teenage daughter's bedroom and finding, on the wall a poster of this, not a guy with long hair, but a guy with not enough hair. He's had the top shaved off. That would be the equivalent of the sort of the radical young hooligan out to destroy society that you had in the 16th century. So Luther makes his way across Germany to Worms. When he arrives there, he's met by the great and the good, asking him for advice on all kinds of problems. And then, on Wednesday the 17th of April, 1521, Luther's brought into this great hall. And who is there? Well, the emperor's there. Many church dignitaries are there. The electors of the empire, many of them are there. These are the most important and powerful people in Europe. You have somebody who was an unknown monk just 4 years ago, now standing in this context. And there's a table at the front. And on the table are all these books laid out. And these are all the books and the pamphlets that Luther has published. And as Luther stands up, he indicates that he will answer the questions that he's asked, first in German and then in Latin. That's a provocative gesture. Latin is the universal language of the educated in Europe in the 16th century. Luther's making a point here about him being German. A lot of his works are full of sort of what we've now described as ethnically insensitive comments, particularly about Italians. I don't know if there are any Italians here tonight. Luther was not keen on Italians. Early in the Reformation, he likes painting these pictures of, you just know what's going on in Rome. He said, you have these overweight Italian cardinals sitting around drinking wine. And worse, he says, worse than that, making jokes about the stupid beer-drinking Germans who paid for the whole thing. So Luther really plays this German card from an early stage. When he's brought into this trial, he will answer first in German and then in Latin. Then we come to one of the great mysteries of church history. Something happens here that we just can't explain. Film actually does it quite well. Luther is asked, he's shown all these books, and he said, will you identify all these books as yours, and will you recant their content? Will you take back what you've said in them? That is a no-brainer question. It's obvious that that's going to be the first question that comes. And Luther says, who's had months to prepare for this, and has been trash-talking the opposition for months, Luther says, there are many issues in these books that deal with salvation. I cannot act in haste. I need time to consider my answer to that question. I love the great thing about history is it's the things you can't explain that are the most fun. You just can't explain them. Was it some sneaky strategy to buy a bit of extra time? Was it a moment of doubt? Was he just frightened? Who knows? We just don't know. But the meeting closes quietly, and Luther goes home for the night, comes back the following day, and the question is then repeated. Luther's reply, first of all, he says, well, I'm inexperienced, so you must pardon me that my manners are not those of a courtier. Then he says, my works can be divided into three. There are books that deal with piety and morals that even my opponents have liked. So I can't recount those because many of the good Catholic people in this room would also have to recount them. Secondly, he says, I've written against the papacy, but the papacy has destroyed and tortured so many souls, I could not possibly retract those. And then rather cleverly he says, oh, and by the way, the very reason we're having an imperial council here, of course, is not specifically to deal with me. It's just been convenient to bring me along. You were convening this council long before you decided to bring me here. Why? Because the papacy needs cleaning up. He says, so I've attacked the papacy, and you, by convening this council, implicitly agree with my attacks. And third, he says, I've written against individuals who defend Roman tyranny. Those are fundamentally sound, he said, though sometimes I've been a bit over the top in my criticisms of others. They were always a bit over the top in the 16th century. I got my students recently to read a book by a guy called Martin Bucer, a 16th century reformer, on pastoral theory in the 16th century. And one of them came up to me and said, "Oh, those were the days, Dr. Tribb," he said, "when you could refer to your congregation as a pack of dogs." And I thought, yes, overstatement. When Luther overstated things, he really overstated them. Luther's told these distinctions are all specious. And that, of course, is when he makes his most remarkable speech. "Unless," he says, "I am convinced by the testimony of the Scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust either in the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves, I am bound by the Scriptures I have quoted, and my conscience is captive to the Word of God. I cannot and I will not retract anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. May God help me. Amen." And he may or may not have said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." That occurs in later accounts. If he didn't say it, he should have said it. It's kind of cool. I leave that up to you as to whether you think he said it or not. And then he's whisked out of the room by two imperial bodyguards while the Spanish delegates are calling for him to be marched out immediately and burned. And then, interestingly enough, he's saved by a strange coincidence. A series of posters appear in Worms. And on these posters is just a shoe. Posters with a shoe on. What could be more harmless than that? These indicate that a group called the Bunchu are right there in Worms. Who are the Bunchu? Well, they were the IRA or the Al-Qaeda of their day. Terrorists. And the Diet of Worms really goes out with a whimper, because suddenly they realize they've been infiltrated by extremely dangerous peasant terrorist group. That then brings Luther to the end of the Diet of Worms. I don't have time really to take on his life for the next. He will live for another 25 years. A couple of high points that I would highlight. His marriage in 1525 to Catherine von Bora. I noticed there's a little book on her at the back. One of the sweetest characters of the Reformation. The story is, of course, as the Lutheran Reformation spreads across the German lands, slowly but surely the monasteries are closed down. And the nunneries are closed down. And this group of nuns, their nunneries closed down, and they escape. They escape in a cart carrying a load of fish barrels. So these ladies are all in fish barrels. And they're brought to Wittenberg. Can you imagine? The 16th century did not smell well anyway, I'm pretty sure, but they must have smelled particularly bad when they came out of fish barrels. And the obvious thing to do, when you've got a bunch of nuns arrive, what do you do with them? Well, in the 16th century, it's a patriarchal society. They need men to look after them. So you pair them off. Who do you pair them off with? Well, you're closing down the monastery. The obvious people to pair them off with are the monks. So they just get together and Luther pairs them all off, and there's one left at the end. Luther's he's by 16th century standards in 1525, he's very middle-aged, and he's very established as a bachelor, and he has no intention of getting married. But there's one left. So he decides to do the decent thing and marry the remaining nun. Can you imagine, it must have been like, remember when you were at school and they chose teams, and it was always awful to be the last guy chosen, the last pick, I think they called it. Oh, hated it. He marries the last pick. And it becomes a blissfully happy marriage. The names of those other nuns are lost forever. But they have numerous children. She is, as I said, a great home brewer. Rather distasteful, but one of Luther's medical problems, he suffered very badly from constipation. And there was a certain brew that his wife could do that would solve his constipation problem, to put it sort of politely. And we have letters from him where he'd be away and he would write to her and say, "I'm on my way home, can you brew me a barrel of that stuff, because I'm constipated." I feel if I emailed my wife to that effect or something, she wouldn't... That would be too much information email for her, I think. So, they had this, as I started off, Luther is a very human person, that the humanity comes through. We tend to think of, you know, Luther is the most famous, most infamous man in Europe, and we tend to assume that there must have been money that went along with that, but there wasn't. In the 1530s and 1540s, Luther and his wife had to take other employment to make ends meet. He and his wife worked as gardeners and did gardening for people in Wittenberg. Luther also did carpentry. He set himself up as a carpenter. Apparently his carpentry was so awful and he had so many complaints that he had to abandon it, probably for his own safety. I'll close with two anecdotes that I think bring out the delightfulness of Luther. You know, he's a man who understood his own weaknesses very much. And, you know, he wrote some things that were terrible and he lived to regret. But he had a daughter who died very young. I think she was 3 or 4. And he writes this account of going to the undertaker's to see the coffin being prepared for her. And talking about his disbelief that something so small could have died. It's a very, very beautiful passage in Luther's writing. And the other incident is, which I often use an example at Westminster to try to remind students that however important and busy they think they are, they're not that important and that busy. Luther goes to get his hair cut one day, and his hairdresser is a bit of a character, a guy called Peter the barber, just says to Luther, I'm struggling to pray. How do I revitalize my prayer life? Luther goes home and he writes a kind of 10-page treatise on prayer for his hairdresser. I think that's quite remarkable that Luther, who is a pastor, a statesman, a politician, the leader of the Reformation in the Holy Roman Empire, when one of his parishioners raises a pretty mundane issue for him, Luther responds by writing a little treatise that we still have today. It's called A Treatise on Prayer, Letter to Peter the Barber. Peter the Barber has a slightly tragic end in that a year or two later, I don't know exactly how he ended, but he has a tragic life. That a year or two later, he gets into a debate with his brother-in-law. Peter gets drunk, and his brother-in-law gets drunk as well, and becomes convinced that he's invulnerable to injury. So he persuades Peter to stab him with a sword. Sadly, the brother-in-law was very, massively overestimated his invulnerability skills and dies as a result of being stabbed. And Peter's sentenced to death for murder. And then Luther intervenes. So, he says this is an accident, and he gets the death sentence commuted to a life of exile, and Peter has to move out of Wittenberg and go elsewhere. But the connection with Peter the Barber strikes me as a beautiful example of how the Reformation was always pastoral for Luther. And that in debates about justification, debates about scriptural authority, debates about the atonement, often these can be pursued at a very high level and must be pursued at a very high level. Because there are some very complex and sophisticated ideas that lie behind them. But their importance lies in the fact that they do have a real impact on real individuals, real lives. And that, I think, was what really drove Luther. He would not have chosen, I don't think, to basically go to Worms and face potential burning at the stake had he had his own choice in matters. But it was really his pastoral concern that drove him to that position. I want to talk in more detail tomorrow about Luther's theology. I don't think I saw it at the back there, but if any of you are interested, you want to say, well, what can I read on Luther that would be fun and would give me some idea of how he thinks? Luther's Table Talk. It's published by Christian Focus. It's available as a nice hardback, but relatively inexpensively. Luther had, would sit around drinking with his friends at night and giving out funny anecdotes, and they wrote them down and published them after he died. And there are some funny things there, and there's some not so funny things. I've got a couple I want to read tomorrow about preaching. But for example, he'd talk about his wife and say, somebody said to him once, what does marriage mean to you? And he says, he says two things. He says, one, I go home. He said, and before I used to get into bed and the sheets were always stiff with sweat. But now my wife launders them, so it's nice to get into bed without stiff sheets. But the other thing he says that's more affecting, he says, I go home at night, my head's pounding and I'm depressed because the gospel isn't progressing as it should, the Reformation seeing setbacks, the faculty at the university are falling out with each other, my preaching isn't what it should be, and I just unload all this on my wife, and she says, oh, that's interesting, dear. And do you know that potatoes have gone up again at the market? And he says, and at that point, everything else comes back into perspective and focus. So it's a beautiful book for seeing the humanity of Luther. Those of you who read much Spurgeon, you know, Luther is the sort of the Reformation equivalent of Spurgeon, if you like. That the humanity is worn very easily on the sleeve. So anyway, if you're interested in learning a bit more about Luther, please come back tomorrow. And I want to look tomorrow afternoon at how Luther understood the cross. And then in the evening, I want to look at how Luther, particularly focus on how Luther understood preaching and how that should still be of significance to us today. Thanks for listening so patiently.